Welcome one and all to episode 86 of the Draft Breakdown Podcast. I'm your host, Seth Cox. With me tonight, my co-host, Justin Higdon. And Justin, we're getting to extend the Why Your Scouting Sucks series another week because we have a brave soul, a guy that's actually involved in football, makes a living doing it, and is climbing up the proverbial ladder. Brendan Leister, writer with Draft Browns, when Justin and Brendan were doing all of the work at draftbrowns.com to kind of complete the team focused network of draft coverage, starting with New England Patriots draft, James Christensen and Mike Loico over there, and they expanded Draft Browns, and you know, you guys did a great job, but time and real life got the best of you, and Justin stayed on this side of it where we fake do things and try to make and have fun with it. Brendan, you went the other direction, and now you're a quarterbacks coach for a Division III college, Hiram College. Why don't you just start off by telling us a little bit about that journey and how you know, going from writing about football to actually coaching it, living it, breathing it every single day, has changed, you know, your evaluations.
Yeah. So, started out, I wanted to be an NFL scout. That was my goal starting when I was like 16 years old in high school. And, I got into writing with this small blog called brownsblog.com. Just kind of reporting on news and stuff, but on Twitter, I was always following along with draft Twitter, and I started forming my evaluations. I always loved the NFL draft and everything, and then I started writing with Justin, Ryan, and Mikey at, I think it was brownsdraft.webs.com at first. We wrote there for a year, just writing scouting reports and stuff, still on Twitter, tweeting out our hot takes constantly. Then we went to Draft Browns, and that was, I would say, where we probably gained a lot of followers from that, and I made some connections. Well, actually, to be honest, I made some connections in the NFL with a couple people that gave me some good advice, and I sent them my reports, and some of those people gave me some good feedback as well, so that was really appreciated. Throughout this time, I also was coaching football as well. So, over those years, I coached at the high school level, youth level, and then right when we started to stop writing as much at Draft Brown, that was when I started to coach at Rittman High School after I transferred to the University of Akron. And, so I kind of went, full on into coaching at that point. I continued writing about like quarterbacks, especially at the OBR for the 2016 draft, but I was coaching at Rittman during that time. And then I finished my master's degree this past December, and that was when I decided that I wanted to pursue coaching full time at the college level. So right now I'm in an entry level position. It's not very glamorous, to be honest. And you know, right now actually we have a lot of downtime because it's at the D3 level. Guys don't get paid during the summer, and but I'm looking forward to when things get started in mid-August, and spring ball went very well, so I'm just excited to get started with coaching at the college level when the season begins.
Yeah, Brendan, just to clarify, you had a pretty influential mentor at the NFL level, and that person gave you advice to continue your college education or to get a college degree and to get involved in coaching if that was the direction you wanted to go, or get involved at a very low level type of position in football. And Seth and I have talked about that as far as like a path for people who are very serious about getting jobs in college football or in the NFL. So we look to you as you're one of those guys like Alex Brown, who used to work at Optimum Scouting, who I've met on the All-Star Circuit, who's I believe he got a job as a recruiting coordinator initially with the University of Houston, and he's still there. So you kind of followed that path. You got him, you got your college education, like you said, master's degree, and followed your path as far as the coaching took you. And now to a quarterback coaching role at Hiram University, which is, you know, it just, that you just keep moving up that ladder. You're a young guy, so it's admirable the path that you took, and obviously you got some good advice and you followed that advice, so props to you. We're happy to have that perspective when we look at these scouting reports, because like you and I were really we really steered the ship on Draft Browns in 2014. We worked very closely on developing a Browns centric draft board and studying these quarterbacks, talking about it almost on a, you know, hourly basis at times. So it's going to be fun to get some perspective and talk about where we got things right, where we got things wrong.
Yeah, most definitely. We always had a great time at Draft Browns, and I think back on those times very in a very positive way. It really changed, like, my years. I'm just really grateful for the years with Draft Browns, and just still even just all the takes I see on Twitter from so many people that I respect so much. I definitely would not be where I am or who I am without Twitter, the people I've met on there, you guys. Brian Burns is another person who I met on Twitter who is a mentor to me, one of my best friends, honestly. I talk to him every week, I mean, almost every day, honestly. And I've just met so many people on Twitter, and I would not be nearly the football mind, although I realize that there is so much that I don't know, but I would not be nearly where I am without the people that I've met on Twitter and through writing. So I'm just very grateful, and I love keeping up with it still.
There you have it, Seth. Twitter is not all trash.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you find the right niche, you can get out of the trash, that's for sure. let's get into this 2014 draft talk. And one of the things that came out for you was Johnny Manziel was your quarterback one, Brendan. And when you looked at it at the time, the thing that you took the most grief over it was that you had Manziel over Teddy Bridgewater. Now we can go big picture and say you had Manziel over the NFL's favorite, Blake Bortles. We can go bigger picture and say you had Manziel over the guy that's been the best quarterback from that class, Derek Carr. But let's focus to start on this Manziel Bridgewater paradigm, because when you looked at it back in 2014, there could not have been two prospects that play the same position that do it a different way, more than Manziel and Bridgewater. And I talked about this last week, and Justin and I have talked about this on the show, you know, ad nauseum before. I think a lot of times people fall in love with style of play just as much as they do of what the player does in the context of, you know, a scouting evaluation. But I want to hear from you exactly, you know, why Manziel over Bridgewater.
So that year, I actually put in a lot of time charting the passes of the quarterbacks in that class. With Manziel, I charted, I believe, 22 of his 26 games. I charted over, I think, around 20 games with Teddy Bridgewater. I charted over 10 of Bortles, over 10 of Carr, and a number of other guys as well. Aaron Murray, Stephen Morris, Zach Mettenberger. That's just a few others that come to mind, Taj Boyd. But in the end, Manziel actually charted out as the most accurate quarterback. And I wasn't just charting passes for completion percentage. I was charting for ball placement, as in putting the ball where it needs to be rather than just throwing completions. Because if, in my opinion, as a quarterback coach, if my quarterback is getting completions to the receivers, but he's throwing it behind him, throwing it below their waist to the point where they need to bend over to catch the ball or jump up in the air to catch the ball, that means that we're not going to maximize our yards after the catch. And that's really a problem at the NFL level. So Manziel was the most accurate guy in the class. I could have done a better job looking back on it of separating passes thrown from the pocket and outside the pocket. I didn't do a very good job of that. So that is something I would have changed. But overall, Manziel was the most accurate. So that was a big deal to me. I also just loved the way that he thrived inside and outside of the context of the play. I still have a thing for quarterbacks that can go beyond what the coach calls. I mean, Patrick Mahomes played a similar style, and he was my top quarterback in this past class. So that just kind of gives you an idea of what I really like in that position. With Bridgewater, I really thought that he was more just a game manager, like an Alex Smith type. That was actually the comparison I made at the time. I thought he struggled to throw the ball down the field accurately, and I didn't think he had a very aggressive mentality on the field either. I also thought that the windows that Manziel was throwing into at times, I just thought that he had more balls, so to speak, with throwing into tight windows, testing those windows down the field in the SEC. I just noticed the difference when I watched the two guys throwing to the intermediate levels of the field. Looking back on it, I would say Bridgewater probably threw with better anticipation, but he was also thrown to a lot of wide open guys underneath in that West Coast offense at Louisville. And I stand by that evaluation. I do realize that Bridgewater's had a much better NFL career than Manziel did, but I stand by it talent-wise, and I think that Manziel could have had a good career if he would have had his head on straight and actually worked at the NFL level.
Yeah, we talked about that last week, actually, where I don't – you know, obviously Manziel is a miss because he's out of the league right now.
Of course.
But we saw when he played and when he was engaged, when he knew he was going to be the starter and when he had a full round of practice reps, he actually showed that he could be a pretty good player. Now, he had a good game against Pittsburgh. He had a good game against Seattle where he was moving them down the field against tough defenses. So I could see why you would – you know, I feel the same way about him. I stand by having him above those other quarterbacks. I do have a little bit more caution now, as you alluded to, when quarterbacks excel within the pocket versus outside the pocket. I can see the NFL has a great obsession with that. But you touched on something, and as a quarterback coach, we've talked about how, you know, you've told me how quarterback coaches, offensive coordinators, even head coaches feel comfortable with an arm, a guy who can play within the structure of the offense. He doesn't have to be the most physically gifted guy. He doesn't have to be the best, the strongest arm or the best athlete. But he is a player that makes a coach feel comfortable. Is this why some evaluators had Bridgewater over Manziel?
Oh, I would definitely say so, because he came from a system where he was playing under center. He was taking those drops where he was it was play-action passes. He was turning his back to the defense, faking handoffs to the running backs in the I formation. You just didn't see those things from Manziel. So that's so much easier of an evaluation for a scout or a coach, especially for a coach, when they can look at a guy on tape and just say, well, I've seen this guy do what I asked my guys to do. I haven't seen Manziel do that. And another thing is just the trust factor. I just think there was a lot of looking back on it now. And I mean, I knew it at the time, but off the field as well as on the field, there were times where Manziel just showed very risky behavior. And I think if you look at Teddy Bridgewater, I mean, nothing about him is risky. So if you're talking about in a league where you've got 32 general managers, 32 head coaches, 32 OCs, and everybody is trying not to get fired, there's a much higher chance of a player like Manziel with the risk factor getting you fired than a player like Bridgewater, who may not make the spectacular play out of structure. And he may not push the ball down the field like you want a quarterback to, but he's not going to make those risky plays that might lose you games and get you fired down the road.
Bridgewater's knees, his skinny knees, did turn out to be risky, though, which is crazy because, you know, this is something we've joked about. Not the knees. That's not a joke. You know, Seth and I both have bad knee injuries. But the fact that a lot of people on Twitter – went to bat for Teddy Bridgewater like he was a close relative of theirs. Mm-hmm. And he was like the guarded son of that whole draft class. And to be honest, when he's been on the field, he's left a lot to be desired still, because for the physical limitations, the downfield throwing that you mentioned. There were a couple other quarterbacks in that class that people grew high on, some people borderline obsessed with, even up to this past offseason. I was fortunate enough to go on the All-Star Circuit tour that year and hit the Senior Bowl. Brendan, I want you to talk about why you and I didn't fall in love with Derek Carr or Jimmy Garoppolo that year and why we're still not believers in Jimmy Garoppolo.
So first on Carr, I just remember something really stood out when I was charting his passes. There was one game where he threw like 50 or so passes, I think, under 5 yards. That offense at Fresno State was just, it made it so tough to evaluate him. I wasn't really privy to his early career stuff, but I remember Lewis Riddick talking about how he played under center his first couple of years and how he was such an easy evaluation because of that. But I didn't really see those games. The games I saw, he was dink and dunk, throwing short passes and then just throwing bombs down the field. And then if you watch him closely, it was a lot of struggles under pressure as well, where he'd fade and throw off his back foot. He wouldn't step up in the pocket consistently and just accuracy issues in general. So that was why I wasn't completely sold on him, but I did at the time feel that he did have a high upside. And honestly, he's a very good quarterback for today's NFL, but I still don't think he's reached that upside that I saw at that point. I mean, I wouldn't consider him a superstar by any means, although I do believe he's a very good NFL quarterback and definitely the best quarterback from that draft class. With Jimmy Garoppolo, the big thing that stood out to me was I just thought he was so what is the word? He just had a lot of struggles with pressure. I mean, anytime there was any type of bodies around him, he would kind of cower. And I remember seeing moments where it was Blaine Gabbert-esque, where he would just drop to the ground and he really wouldn't stand in there and make the tough throw. And when you're watching a guy that plays at Eastern Illinois, it's kind of hard to trust that. When you compare that with going to the NFL, making plays at that level, he did have a very quick release, as he still does. But I think the thing with Jimmy Garoppolo is he's just really benefited now from playing in New England under Tom Brady. And I think it seems like he is a guy that definitely has always had it figured out off the field. When you compare him with a guy like Manziel, where Manziel did not put the work in off the field, you can see with a guy like Jimmy Garoppolo and the way he played in those two or three games this past season, you can really see what putting in the work over time, what that can do for a quarterback if they really just work at it and grind and keep their nose down and stay out of trouble.
New England is extremely, extremely high on Garoppolo to the point where they weren't really willing to trade him for like a couple second-round picks. They seem to have a plan for him going forward. I know some people are speculating that this might be Tom Brady's last year and that Garoppolo would then be ready to take over as a starter in New England. So we'll see. And Jimmy G is like a to be determined, but I just remember like being at the Senior Bowl thinking, why are people propping this guy up to a degree? I mean, to be frank, Carr was the best quarterback at the Senior Bowl that year. The other three guys that went in front of him were all underclassmen. So I think that played out the way we expected. And Carr was our quarterback for on draftbrowns.com that year. And we thought he would be a high second round pick, which is where he went. And yet he still feels like a miss. So Garoppolo yet to be determined, 4 years in. And we just really don't know much more than a couple of games. And then he's been hurt. So
that's a future Arizona Cardinal starting quarterback Blaine Gabbert. Thank you very much.
The bridge to Blake Bortles, right, Seth?
Yep. It's going to be a great future for the Arizona Cardinals. When you look at this class and you know, you kind of hit on it, whether or not Derek Carr is a superstar in the league, whether or not he's worth being paid the highest salary in the NFL, is not the question. The question is, can you win with him? And the answer unequivocally is yes. So at that point, and something I talk about with draft picks, but it really goes way, way beyond the draft, is the quarterback tax. And when you look at it, you look at, you know, guys, Russell Wilson and now Derek Carr, day two players that were on very, very team-friendly deals that then just got paid a substantial amount of money. And now, you know, the question is, have they lived up to it? Are they worth it? But the answer is yes, because they're still winning. Obviously, now Carr has to go out and win more. But when you look at it, and as a Browns fan, you guys know, and as a Cardinals fan, I know, there's really no limit to what you would pay a guy to get you into the playoffs year in and year out. Like, you know, you want one of my kids, I will give it to you.
Well, you have a few. You know, I mean, you can afford
right,
that.
But, yeah, right, but I mean, that's the point. There's no cap to what you pay a quarterback that gives you a chance to win. I mean, we make fun of the Chiefs and Alex Smith all you want, but we saw that. They gave up, you know, 2 second round picks, and they've paid him, I think, $18-19 million a year. And they go to the playoffs every year, and every year you go, well, this isn't the year. They're not going to win. But at least they're there while your Browns are sitting at home. Well, my Cardinals, you know, are rebounding from a 7-8-1 season. You can't really put a cap on what being competitive and getting a shot to the playoffs every year gets you, because the flip side of that is really, when you look at it, the Browns or the Jaguars or, you know, the Cardinals before the Palmer and Warner years. And nobody wants to deal with that.
So let's talk about draft Twitter's favorite son after Teddy Bridgewater. Okay. I think I can speak for all three of us, really. Probably one of the most bizarre things about draft Twitter in 2014 was the love for Wyoming quarterback Brett Smith, who came into the draft as an underclassman. He was, I think came in about 6'2", 200 pounds, maybe about 205 pounds. He was a very good athlete, only 21 years old entering the draft. But we had people talking about him being a better version of Manziel. We had people talking about him being a first-round caliber player. I remember distinctly seeing him as high as 13th overall on one draft board. And there were people who insisted that if you liked Manziel, you were going to like Brett Smith. Obviously, that was not the case with you, Brendan, or myself, and I know with Seth as well. What was the deal with Brett Smith? Why? What did people see in Brett Smith, and why did his supporters dig their heels in so hardcore, even to the point where when he was not invited to the combine and the writing was on the wall, they were still insistent that he was a top three-round player?
Start off, I just think that someone made a take. Like, this happens on Twitter sometimes. Someone makes a take. It's hot. People think about it for a second, and they're like, huh. Maybe this guy's onto something. And then it kind of just spreads like wildfire and everybody starts buying into it, especially with a player that was so divisive as Manziel, where there was a lot of people that really liked him, such as ourselves, and then a lot of people that also just couldn't stand him. And they would always point to that play against Alabama where it was third down and he chucked it up in the air. Like, that was the only play that people wanted to talk about when the guy played 26 games. So, but the thing with Brett Smith, I mean, when I watched him, I didn't see a great arm. I didn't see an accurate quarterback. I thought he was a below-average decision maker, and I just didn't think he played very well from the pocket. He's also not in a good conference, obviously. But it was just crazy the way that people would stand up for him. And I think that people just really wanted to be right about that. Like, when they were saying that about Brett Smith being better than Johnny Manziel, like, they just – I think that was just something they felt like clinging to. I don't know why. I think it was the hatred of Manziel, kind of, and the similarities in athletic ability, maybe. But, I mean, on the field, I never thought there was a comparison at all. And I'm not going to say that he can't play in the NFL, because I am one of those people that will say that I think some guys never get a chance and they could have played. But at the same time, I'm not going to say that he absolutely could have, and I didn't see much evidence of that.
Yeah, I think I know Brett Smith went to the CFL. I think he had a few cups of coffee as far as as getting on the field there. But whereas we just talked about with Manziel when he did get on the field and where he was practicing regularly and apparently sober, that he showed those glimpses. We would see him play well, and then we'd get some hot takes about, oh, he actually is better than Teddy Bridgewater. We'd see takes like that on Twitter. Obviously, I don't think that's a fair statement to make with how his career played out. But what we do know is Brett Smith did not get drafted, only got tryouts. He didn't even get a guaranteed NFL undrafted free agent contract. So, and I think you hit the nail on the head. Somebody comes up with a take. People want to run with it. They want to be right about it. It combines with their distaste for another prospect that they feel similar. And I think the only similarities that I saw between the two is athleticism, because there was just no – Brett Smith's playing for Wyoming, granted, not as good of a team as Texas A&M, but he did not have the skills to improvise the way Johnny Manziel did. He did not have the football IQ that Johnny had. Johnny was a natural in a lot of ways. And his physical stature and obviously his demons really limited that. Brett Smith was not a natural in those ways. I felt kind of bad for the guy getting feedback. I don't know if I can't get into his head about why he declared early, but it seemed like an odd choice at the time, and it turned out to be a very poor choice for him to come out early. I know there was a coaching change coming up that a lot of times spurs guys to make decisions like that. But it just seemed like he was drawn out by the media, and it was unfortunate.
Yeah.
The last quarterback we want to talk about this class, and the reason we're talking so much about quarterbacks with Brendan was because, as he said, he charted literally all of the seniors and did a lot of work on them. So you're talking about a guy that, you know, went through it, and that's what this is about. This is about evaluating the evaluators and getting to understand what they saw and missed on. One of the things you guys both hit on, and Brendan, this carries over to our next topic, was how bad Zach Mettenberger was and how good Odell Beckham Jr. and Jarvis Landry were, and how you were able to extrapolate just how good those wide receivers were and just how bad Mettenberger was. Because we saw a lot of people get caught up in the idea that Mettenberger was good, and having two NFL caliber receivers, which Landry and Beckham Jr. obviously are, or were at the time and are now, meant that he could play in the NFL because he would have more players like Beckham Jr. and Landry next to him and allow him to kind of grow. But when you look at it from a
plus he was tall, Seth. He was
tall and pocket passer. A strong arm. But when you look at it just from like a way, like a big overview of statistical analysis, he wasn't good statistically in college. And that was with two, let's just call them great, because they both are, two great wide receivers coming out. So why getting to the NFL would we assume he would take that next step? As I said in this long-winded introduction, you were able to extrapolate that. What did you see that made you buy into that?
Well, to start off, one of the first things that comes to mind is I remember texting one of my friends that works in the NFL, and I asked him about Mettenberger, and the guy said that he was a problem off the field or something. I asked him to elaborate a little bit, and all he said was just that he had drug issues. I'm not going to go into any more detail than that, but he had drug issues. I believe he had some kind of issue with an incident with a woman at Georgia, and he ended up having to leave Georgia to go to LSU. So to start off, I didn't trust him off the field, and I think that's huge for quarterbacks. I know that this kind of sounds different when you consider how much I like Manziel, but I didn't know that Manziel had drug issues, though. I didn't know that he had issues with women either. So I think those are two different issues. I think legal issues are different. So I'm going to say that up front. But on the field,
I agree with you.
Yeah. we didn't know about Manton.
Yeah, we didn't know. We heard about Mettenberger. We knew about the incident at Georgia. That's what got him kicked out of Georgia and why he ended up at LSU. But you're right. With Manziel, that was stuff we did not know.
Exactly. But on the field, I just thought one of the things that stood out to start off with was Mettenberger just had such slow feet. He was a sloth in the pocket. And in today's NFL, I think it's very hard to operate. Well, just in general in football, it's hard to operate at a high level if you don't have good feet. That's one of the first things that I look for in a quarterback is how do they move in the pocket, their pocket presence, the way that they can move. I just think it's huge. You know, people might fire back at me talking about Tom Brady or Peyton Manning not being great athletes, but if you watch those guys move in the pocket, they are very, very good athletes for what they have to do to play the quarterback position from within the pocket. And Zach Mettenberger was not that way at all. He took a lot of hits. He took a beating. Actually, the last play of his college career, he took a huge hit and threw it into double coverage. It was just a really ugly play, and that's the play that always sticks in my mind about him. But I just think he really relied on those two wide receivers a ton. He would just chuck it up to them at any time. And the thing is, these aren't just two NFL wide receivers at the time. These were two NFL wide receivers with elite ball skills for that level. Like, these guys could, like, OBJ and Jarvis Landry could track the ball at a level that few college wide receivers can. They could go up and get the ball with one hand. They could high point it. They could dive for the ball, lay out, whatever you needed them to do. So Mettenberger's ball placement, I mean, it was just all over the place. And Seth even alluded to the fact that his stats weren't very good. So that just shows you that he was clearly not a very good quarterback if he was throwing with this poor ball placement, still getting completions, and the stats weren't good. Also, you just look at the team around him. I mean, he just his talent all over the place. There was a couple linemen on in front of him, I believe, that are playing in the NFL now. And then also his running back was Jeremy Hill. So, I mean, he was on a very talented team, and they didn't really win a ton of games, which you would expect from a team like that. I know he did get hurt, but I was not a fan of much about him. It really comes back to the slow feet and the decision-making skills and the accuracy.
I can remember Mettenberger, like, rifling some screen passes and some swing passes at Jeremy mm-hmm. Hill and just thinking, oh, my God, like – no touch. He had no touch, no feel for what it was like to throw a 5-yard pass versus like a 15 or 20 yard out where he could actually rifle that ball because he did have the arm to do that. Mm-hmm. But you and I talked about he would leave those receivers out to dry with the high ball placement on some of those contested throws where they would take a shot to the ribs or to the back or crossing the middle of the field, throwing low or throwing on the back hip, limiting yards after catch. It was a mess if you really looked at Mettenberger. And you mentioned defeat too. And you and I were just coming off a couple seasons watching Brandon Weeden play for Cleveland, and we saw it. We saw the same type of issues with defeat mm-hmm. that we saw in Weeden, who was actually, I think, a better athlete than Mettenberger. Yeah. So – it was just it was so apparent to us that those receivers made Mettenberger look good, not vice versa. And so to segue from that.
Well, I have one more point.
Sure, go ahead.
So this has always kind of been my hot take on this whole situation because that was always a confounding situation to me, just Mettenberger playing with those all-star receivers. I mean, you just don't see that very often. And but I really believe – that OBJ and Landry were lucky to play with him because they showed off their ball skills consistently. I mean, it sounds like I'm making a joke, but I'm serious. Like, you got to see these guys jump in the air, catch one-handed balls. I remember Landry, there was a ball where Mettenberger threw it like sky high, it comes down, he jumps up over the guy, diving backward, lands on his back, catches the ball. It's just the catches these guys were making were incredible. They were set up. It was like alley-oops. You know, it was like watching the All-Star game or something. I mean, Mettenberger is just chucking it up there, and these phenomenal athletes are going up and getting the ball. It was just, I mean, if the quarterback was more accurate, if he made better decisions, you would have never seen these highlight plays by them. It would have just all been like catches in stride and run after the catch. So I actually think those two receivers were kind of lucky to play with such an inaccurate, erratic quarterback.
Right. And again, we learned that they can take a hit.
Yep.
So Beckham, Odell Beckham Jr. has probably, by most accounts, become the best receiver from this class, a loaded class. We talked about Mike Evans, who was my favorite wide receiver. We talked about him last week. Should Odell Beckham Jr. have been the wide receiver one in this class? And if so, why? Why wasn't he our wide receiver one? In my case, I think he was wide receiver three.
I think it's hard to say because for me, when they were coming out, I had OBJ and Evans tied from what I remember. And then I had Watkins a little bit below. I just think a lot of people really fell in love with Sammy Watkins and what he brought to the table on the screens and those short plays where he'd catch the ball in space and run after the catch. You know, he was a dynamic athlete. And another thing with Sammy Watkins was he burst on the scene really early. Like his freshman year, you knew who he was. He just came out the gates as a great player for Clemson. And they played on a bigger stage consistently than Beckham and Evans did. So I think that's why people latched on to him. But I was just never a big fan of Watkins' route running ability. I thought that he had the ability to turn into a good player, but I just thought he was farther away. With Beckham, looking back, I would say that he should have been regarded as the best receiver, but you can also make a case that Mike Evans could really turn into a great wide receiver just with his physical tools and the fact that I think Tampa Bay does a good job of asking him to run the routes he's good at, which is a very key thing, in my opinion, for offensive coordinators to do. But Beckham, in hindsight, he definitely should have been. I mean, he's just such an explosive player with rare ball skills. And another thing I'm going to bring up that always comes to mind when I think of those guys is I remember him catching kickoffs one-handed in the end zone over his head nonchalant. Like, I know that doesn't really translate to the NFL, but that just tells you the type of athlete this guy was. He would make these nonchalant, one-handed kickoff catches. He did like two of them that I remember, and it was incredible. I mean, he's just an otherworldly athlete, and he's shown that in the NFL, obviously. So I feel pretty good about the way that I ranked those three receivers. But I think Watkins has probably played a little bit better than I expected him to. I mean, he still gets a lot of hype from fantasy people I know, even though he's hurt all the time.
With Landry, I remember the debate early on was who was the best LSU receiver because Landry was so good. He had such great hands, and he was so good at catching those contested balls and holding on after those big hits. It turned out he was not nearly the athlete that Odell Beckham Jr. was. And we kind of see that in their pro games as well. As good as Jarvis Landry has been, you see that the role he specializes in is different than what Odell Beckham Jr. can do. He's just not – he can't quite do what Odell Beckham Jr. can do. Was it fair for people to criticize Landry after the combine? I know I personally dropped him about half a round. He ended up being my 57th overall player, which translated to like a late second, early third round grade. He ends up going in the second round. Was that fair with that disastrous of a combine, or was do you think it was injury issues? What do you think happened there, and how has he been able to overcome that?
Well, I think it was always kind of clear that Landry wasn't the best athlete. Just when you watch him, he didn't have the elite burst. He wasn't the most explosive guy. I mean, he did make those phenomenal catches like we've talked about, and he was very tough after the catch. But I think it was always clear that he wasn't going to be like a superstar receiver, which I know a lot of Miami fans and a lot of people in general probably disagree with me, but I wouldn't view Jarvis Landry as a superstar receiver as where OBJ is. With Landry, I think he's more of a number two, a possession receiver. Like if you could have at the NFL level an OBJ and a Landry, like they had in LSU, then you have a dominant top two, but you don't necessarily want Landry to be your number one receiver. It's more of a possession guy. He's great at running underneath routes, intermediate routes. He's not going to beat you down the field as that well, although he can because he can go over the top of defenders. But he's not going to consistently explode by people. He's not going to explode by people after the catch either. He's just a really tough guy, dependable, and definitely a guy that you want on your team. But I would say that it was fair because he didn't have the athletic ability that you look for at that position. And I know that you do a ton of that stuff, and I love the stuff that you do when it comes to the data and the athletic ability and all that stuff. And I just think at wide receiver, it's huge. Athletic ability is an enormous component, and if you don't have it, then it's tough to rank a guy that doesn't have it above guys that do. So this was a big film versus data debate, I know, but he's clearly turned into a good player. But to say that he was a no-brainer first round pick or anything, I definitely don't think that was the case.
And I think we saw this argument come up again last year in the 2016 draft with Laquon Treadwell, where he had a poor showing in terms of athletic testing, in terms of combine. Well, he didn't run the 40 at the combine. And, you know, he ends up catching one pass last year. Mm-hmm. So you see now Landry, I think his competitiveness is one of the things you and I talked about at the time was that Landry kind of had a running back mentality playing mm-hmm. receiver. He was just not afraid to take hits, and he was going to gut out extra yards. And I don't know that we saw that type of mentality out of Treadwell, dog him, but we saw guys dig their heels in on Treadwell despite the poor athletic testing, even when we knew already that a Jarvis Landry, who was a very successful collegiate player, maybe even more successful than Treadwell was the year he came out in the draft, you saw that the testing did hurt his stock. It turns out Treadwell still goes late first round, but that looks like a mistake early on.
Yeah, and it's funny because I'm saying all this stuff about Landry right now, but I actually did buy into Treadwell. I mean, when I watched him, I just thought that he looked on video like a faster guy than he ran, and that might have been a mistake on my part. I don't know. We'll see how he plays over the next few years. I'm always preaching patience with young players because I just believe that it takes some guys a while, takes some guys a short time. It just depends on the team, depends on the player. There's so many variables that go into developing these players and getting the most out of them. But with Treadwell, I actually, to this time, I missed on him just because I thought he looked faster on film than he was. So we'll see how that goes. But
when you look at the class overall, Brendan, and you start with Jadeveon Clowney, and this was something we've talked about with Myles Garrett this year and your Brownies, but every once in a while you get this, he's the consensus guy. Like he's the best. You can't pass on him. And then there's one or two players that are actually better. When you look at that class, you look at from the defensive line or pass rushing or whatever you want to call it, force playing positions, you have Aaron Donald and Khalil Mack. Were the evaluations simply wrong coming out of college, or was Mack's conference and Donald's size reason enough to push them behind Clowney?
Well, I think this is another herd mentality thing, honestly. Like with Clowney, people kind of latched on to him being the unanimous no-brainer number one so early that there was no room for anybody to really challenge that, kind of like with Myles Garrett this past season. I think maybe if the right team had the number one pick that year, they would have taken Aaron Donald. Maybe they would have taken Khalil Mack, but that team decided Clowney was the best, so they took him. But I would say that Clowney probably had the least amount of holes, although if you look at the numbers, he didn't have as many sacks as last year as you would want out of that number one no-brainer, unanimous number one pick. He also wasn't really a bendy guy either. I know that I believe you referenced Justice's formulas earlier. I don't even think that he was a force player. So that's another red flag if you think about that too. But I was just a huge Aaron Donald fan, honestly. I thought that he was just so explosive. Technique, dominant, made a lot of impact plays in the backfield, in the run game and the pass game. And I remember, I'll just bring the Browns into this a little bit, but people were sold on the Browns defensive line at that point. They were talking about how Phil Taylor and Ataba Rubin, and I don't even know who else, honestly. Do you remember who else was on the defensive line at that point, Justin?
I think they had just signed Desmond Bryant too.
Okay.
They had, yeah. He was a signee from the Joe Banner Lombardi time. So it was, yeah, you're right. There was just this thing that they didn't need help on the front seven. Yep. And that was, yeah, I think most Browns fans actually wanted Sammy Watkins.
Yeah. Four. Yeah, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, but I actually would have.
What happened, but.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it couldn't have been worse, right?
It could not have been. There's no doubt about that. But I would have,
guys.
What'd you say?
I said Justin Gilbert's not on the show sheet. We won't discuss that.
Yeah, but yeah, I thought Aaron Donald definitely had a chance of being the best player in the draft. Manziel was my number one player in the draft. I thought I'd throw that out there, just so people know that he wasn't my number one quarterback. He was my number one player. So you can give me even more heat if you want. You can at me on Twitter. I don't care. It's 3 or 4 years later. 3 years. Yeah. But I would have loved Donald in Cleveland. I didn't care about the need, the perceived need at the time. That's another thing, because I know you guys like to get into draft philosophy a little bit on here. I really hate, like, perceived need and drafting for that in the moment. Needs change all the time. There's undrafted free agent players that pop up every year and they claim starting jobs. And I know that it's hard to count on that, but that happens. And I think it's smart when teams draft a year ahead, or they just draft the best player available and then figure it out, or let a player that they weren't expecting to let go leave. Because at that point in time, people thought that Phil Taylor was a good player and they thought he was going to reach his second contract and all this stuff. Well, he didn't. Isn't he retired at this point? I don't even know if he plays in the NFL anymore. So, I just think Aaron Donald would have been a great pick for the Browns at 8, at 4, whatever. And he definitely had everything you look for, in my opinion. I don't really care about the size, not to ramble on too long.
Yeah, and Donald was one of those – like, people are always looking for those outliers, I think, like Geno Atkins. Mm-hmm. And so they end up propping up a guy like Dominique Easley, when the thing about Donald was – he actually did check every single box that you want, except for the size. He was a world-class athlete for when you adjust for size. I mean, he ran a 4.7 at 285 pounds, just a sub 4.7. Incredibly strong dude, incredibly productive player too, and then had that dominant Senior Bowl. So he goes through – if you have a checklist for a player, he checks every single box except for that – ideal size for an interior defensive lineman, because he came in at 285 pounds. But if you look at it, like, his arm length came in at almost 33 inches. It was 32 5/8. So he wasn't the tallest guy, but he had long enough arms where it was not the worst thing in the world that he was undersized. He's underweight, but when he's that strong and fast, that kind of negates that too. So you have to look – Donald was one of those, one of the first cases for me when I looked at the total package of the player and I said, you know, size be damned here. This guy is going to be a really good player. He was my 7th overall player, not 1st overall, but I agree with what you said about Clowney too. There was a herd mentality. This was another guy protected from on high by any criticism. If you criticize this guy, it was, well, he played through injury. Well, that sounds really familiar to what happened this past year. So that reminds me. Yeah. The thing about Myles Garrett is he proved to be an actually a superior athlete to what Clowney looked like on paper. But we still don't have those agility drills for Myles. So we'll see. He did put up better sack numbers, though. I'll give him that.
When you look back at this class, one of the things that Justin and I talked about last week was again, the herd mentality, the hype behind Greg Robinson. But you had two guys that on film were just flat out better. There weren't any question about who played better, Zach Martin and Joel Bitonio. Now, you can make a case that Robinson, from a physical standpoint, met the check mark or the boxes of being a tackle, whereas Martin and Bitonio, it was almost universally agreed upon that they would be moving inside. But did we get caught up, and again, the collective we, did we get caught up in what Greg Robinson could be as opposed to what we knew Zach Martin and Joel Bitonio were, Brendan?
I definitely think that's the case. And I've been guilty of that many times over the years, of just, you take these splash plays the guys make and you just think, if this guy could get coached up, become more consistent, just imagine what a world beater he could become. That, I think that was why I missed so bad on Greg Robinson, because I was a big fan of him, his as well. As where with offensive line, I think you really want to look for guys that just don't mess up. I think that's the biggest thing. Like, guys that are consistent, they don't mess up. You don't need the splashy block. You don't need the play where the guy is, you know, on his back getting bent over, the play that's all over the internet getting retweeted. You just need the steady guy that's just sealing off holes, pass protecting, doing the right thing, not making mistakes, not looking like Cam Irving. Oh, but anyway, yeah, I think that people just don't look for consistency enough with offensive linemen.
You know, the point I made last week, and I think this is huge, and one of the reasons why Greg Robinson was a reach now looking back, is starting experience. And this is something that the three of us have all talked about at various points, but I think it's really important now looking back at all the drafts I've looked at over the years to look for 3- and 4-year starters on offensive line, especially if they come from bigger schools, big conferences, Power Five, or, you know, in Martin's case, Notre Dame, you got Bitonio from a Group of Five, but he was a 4-year starter. And then you look at the athletic testing of Bitonio and Martin. So where they're a little undersized as tackles, we, like you said, Brendan, we knew they were going to move inside. And but if you look at their athletic testing, they're on the high end for guards in terms of lateral agility and 3-cone. These are guys with feet. They can move. They've got experience. I think we saw that both of them, this is something I value, and I'm sure you guys agree. When you see on tape, the one part we can glean from that about offensive linemen is if they are nasty and they finish plays. These guys did that. And so looking back, it's almost, you know, I know Greg Robinson had those highlight plays where he's pancaking defensive backs 30 yards down the field, because we know he can get down the field. He ran a great 40 at 330 pounds. But what we saw from Bitonio and from Zach Martin was that they handled their guys consistently at left tackle. You know, with Bitonio, he had some reps, I think, at other positions as well. And then, again, both these guys had very successful stints at the Senior Bowl. So it carries over. You've got 3- and 4-year starters with good athletic testing, with a good Senior Bowl. These guys check all the boxes. And with Greg Robinson, you've got a hope and a prayer that this athletic, you know, I guess explosive, strong behemoth with maybe questionable feet was going to actually develop and become one of these other guys, what they already were, except a bigger version. And it didn't happen. Those other guys have become more dependable. They have the big contracts now to show it.
When you look at the Browns draft class, we all like to point and laugh that they screwed up 2 first-round picks again. And that's what's going
to
be the
legacy. We don't like to.
Well, you don't. You know, LOL Browns. But when you look at the legacy of this draft, that's what's going to be. Justin Gilbert, 9. Manziel, 21, 22, whatever he was. But when you go further, they had a nice draft. And then they were able to get Isaiah Crowell. They got a guy like Christian Kirksey. Obviously, we just talked about Betonio. They did a really nice job of getting building block pieces to create a good team. And Crowell and Kirksey, what did the Browns see? And was the Crowell situation just an instance of where a lot of people knew he was talented, they just didn't want to take a chance on a guy who had already gotten in trouble? And then, you know, versus Kirksey, where it seemed like some really good scouting occurred in that pick.
So with Crowell, I think a lot of people just really had those huge questions about his off field. I mean, I think that's the reason he went undrafted. I remember at the time, I actually thought he was the most talented running back in that class. I remember Matt Waldman. He does really good work on prospects in general, but I really like his takes on running backs generally. And he was a huge fan of Crowell, and I really felt like I learned from his evaluations and in watching him. In the limited sample that we got from Draft Breakdown that year, I was a big fan of his. I thought he was the most talented running back in the class. And I think it was a huge pickup for the Browns, obviously, to get a starting running back as an undrafted free agent. That kind of plays into the point I was making a little bit ago, that, you know, if they don't pick up that guy, then you're thinking, oh, well, running back is a need. Like, you look at that draft class, they took Terrence West earlier, filling a need at running back, but then they got a guy as an undrafted free agent who actually ended up being the starter. They traded away West because of those character concerns that he had and just the overall inconsistency of him as a person and player. With Kirksey, I just think they saw an all-around versatile linebacker. At the time, they clearly realized that he was going to be a bit of a project because he was projecting from playing on the line of scrimmage as an outside linebacker in that 3-4 defense to playing as an inside linebacker in the 3-4 under Mike Pettine. So they clearly realized that he was going to take a couple of years to develop in the run game. But I thought they did a great job with him early on of only playing him on pass downs. They kept Dansby on the field all the time, and then they would kind of platoon Craig Robertson, who moved on to New Orleans and is having a decent career for himself, also an undrafted free agent. But they would play Kirksey on pass downs. They'd play Robertson on rundowns. And then as Kirksey developed as a run defender, he really started to turn into a really good player this past year. And you saw that past season. He just got rewarded with a big contract. But a huge asset that stands out to me when I think of Kirksey at Iowa is just the way that they would use him. I mean, he was so fluid as a pass rusher off the edge, just a very, very fluid athlete with great hips. You just don't see that a lot for guys that transition to inside linebacker. And then also the way that they would use him covering the slot. I mean, he would play press man on fly receivers and cover them down the field and break up passes over the middle. It was really impressive, the athletic ability and versatility that he had, not to mention the fact that he's probably the leader of the Browns defense right now, and I believe a captain 1 or 2 years at Iowa.
One of the things that we've seen, Brendan, and I'm not going to say that the Browns, you know, kind of brought this on, but we've seen, as my daughter's hanging out in the background now, we've seen teams go with these undersized but athletic linebackers. Basically every linebacker out of LSU after Kevin Minter. You know, we saw the Falcons drafted one. Names are escaping me right now. The Buccaneers drafted
one. We had Deion Jones, Quan Alexander.
Yeah. And then this year they had
the two big ones.
Duke Riley. Yeah. And so you see that there's a trend. Again, I don't want to say that the Browns started it, but there's a trend towards, okay, we can take these guys that maybe aren't prototypical size, but they give you something else. They give you this athleticism that other players don't have. Because when you look at a guy like Jamie Collins, he was a special player because he was 6'2", 250, but still ran in the 4'5 range. Whereas Kirksey was what? Did he even weigh 220 pounds coming out?
Yeah, he was 230.
I think he was 230, yeah.
Okay, so yeah. Like mid 220s in reality, get the you get the boost.
Well, but then and Brendan mentioned, the guy Brendan mentioned, Craig Robertson, was an undrafted guy. The Browns signed him as a first-year player. He had spent his first NFL season on a practice squad. And he was another guy who was like 6'1", 225, who fits the mold of what you're talking about. So, I mean, for all of Mike Pettine's horrible shortcomings as a coach, the one thing that they were able to do in his short time was and he and Ray Farmer were able to find these talented linebackers and actually coach them up a bit and turn them into decent players. You know, Kirksey is a holdover from that era, and like Brendan said, he now has a big contract, and he's looked at as a key cog in that defense this year. So, I don't know if they – like you said, Seth, I don't know if they started this trend, but they certainly were able to find players in that mold. And it's for all the screw-ups, there's one silver lining to that cloud.
I want to kind of end with this, and we can, we could go on forever, but the 14 class is just such a great case study in football talent and evaluation and what you see versus what others see and things of that nature. But when you look at a player like Calvin Pryor, I wasn't a fan. And by that, I mean, I think I had him in the like 40 range of players. And I know a lot of people had him like top 20, but I am a Todd Bowles fan. I'm an Arizona Cardinals fan. Bowles was his going to, Bowles got there in 15, I believe it was. And, when you look at fits and the way things work, you look at that and you go, okay, this is going to be perfect. Pryor wasn't a guy I loved, but you look at a guy like Todd Bowles and what the Arizona Cardinals did at safety, where they just brought in guys coached them up and got them to play well. You looked at Pryor and said, this guy can be salvaged. Now, it basically, he's a bust thus far. I mean, 3 years in, I don't know if you can call him anything but what happened with Pryor? Where was the miss at that maybe we'll say 50%? Maybe I think it was probably more, but 50% of evaluators missed. And then a guy like me who wasn't necessarily high on him, I you see that Todd Bowles situation, you go, okay, now he's going to be better, and then he fails again. Is this just a situation where you're like, you just chalk this up as a loss, or is there still a chance that he could find his way?
To this point, I do chalk this up as a loss. I was a fan of his. I just remember the explosive hits that he would make down in the box, as well as the plays over the top that he made playing as a center field player. I just thought that he showed enough in that capacity to become a versatile safety for today's NFL, because in today's game, you need safeties that can play strong and free. It's not typical that you see these cover three defenses like Seattle or Atlanta where guys are playing one position. Most defenses want safety that can play both. So I thought he would fit that well. I think the thing for me, and it was the same thing as with the Greg Robinson situation, was I was seeing these flashes. I was thinking, hey, if he gets coached up in the right situation, he could really turn into a more consistent player. If he shows these flashes more often, he could become a pro bowler just with the ball skills that he showed, the range, the explosiveness as a hitter and in pursuit as well. I just thought that he showed all that, but clearly with the Jets, he just wasn't a consistent enough player for them to trust him, it seems, or maybe he just, I mean, I honestly didn't follow him closely with the Jets, but he clearly didn't earn a second contract. So he's definitely a bust at this point. We'll see if Greg Williams can salvage him.
I mean, could this be a Mark Barron situation?
I think it's possible. I'm just interested to see how they use him exactly, because like I said, I could have seen him playing some free safety, but maybe that was a complete misevaluation on my part. It would be interesting to see them use him in the box in 4-3 situations with Collins and Kirksey on the field too.
Yeah, the early read, I think, is that Pryor could get a shot at playing free safety opposite Jabril Peppers, or he might be the third safety when they go to certain nickel formations. But The one thing, you know, I wasn't very high on Pryor either. This is one where Brendan and I disagreed a little bit that year. Pryor was my, I think, 54th overall player, which came out to a late second round grade. And looking back, maybe that was a little bit too high too, because Pryor was one of those original guys coming out of Louisville, which is now notorious for this, where he lost like 2 inches of height coming out. He was listed at 6'2 or 6'1. He came in at just over 5'11. He tested okay in the shuttle drills, but not a great 40, not explosive. That's okay when we're talking about safeties, because there's a reason they're playing defense instead of offense. But then you look at his overall pass breakups plus interceptions. This is something that we know the great Bill Belichick looks at when he scouts defensive backs. And Pryor had a pretty average total of 21 combined passes defensed. That's interceptions plus pass breakups, 21 combined in 38 career games. That's not the type of number that really screams ball hawk when you're talking about an experienced college player. So there were these flags about Calvin Pryor that indicated that he wasn't a first-round pick. So this is kind of the Jets' own fault for doing this. And but for Cleveland now, they get Pryor for a very cheap cost, and they showed with Jamar Taylor last year that they were able to get something out of a player who the team that traded him had already chalked him up as a bust. And so maybe this is the right fit. I don't know if the Mark Barron situation is going to play out, because Barron was playing Brendan, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was playing weak side linebacker, and that's going to be Kirksey with Cleveland, right?
Yeah, that's three. I'm getting.
Yeah, so it looks like Pryor's going to be that, either that extra safety or possibly free safety if he can win that job. And it's very much up in the air, because the other guys are like Ed Reynolds, and everyone else is escaping me. There's just not much there for free safety with Cleveland. That's one of the criticisms that they got coming out of this draft class, is that they didn't address free safety. So we'll see. I don't have great hopes, but I didn't have great hopes for Jamar Taylor, and he is a guy who played his way into a contract extension. And I think PFF said he's Cleveland's secret superstar. So
yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah, and I will throw out there that I think Ed Reynolds is better than a lot of fans are giving him credit for. I'm not calling him like a great player or anything, but he calmed things down back there last year compared with Ibrahim Campbell and Derek Kindred at free safety.
Yeah, they've had some adventures back there, and hopefully the emphasis on their front seven in terms of pass rush and the linebackers getting the, you know, Collins and Kirksey getting these extensions, hopefully that takes some of the heat off of the defensive backfield, because that's still a work in progress in Cleveland. They got Peppers, the rookie. He's moving back to the defensive backfield after playing like an overhang linebacker last year. And yeah, there's just a lot of moving pieces. Joe Hayden has not looked like the same player over the past few years. It's a mess back there if they don't get pressure on the quarterback. So we'll see. That could be heavily addressed next year. Lord knows they have a ton of picks.
Yep, that's right.
Anything else, Brendan, that you want to hit on the 14 draft or just overall draft Twitter, your career, anything like that?
Yeah, I just had one final thought on the Donald versus Clowney thing. This is just a draft philosophy, football philosophy opinion of mine, and some people might view it as a hot take, but I've always kind of, as a quarterback evaluator, quarterback coach, I've always thought that if you have a dominant interior defensive lineman that can push the pocket and get to the quarterback and create sacks and hits on the quarterback, then I think that's more valuable than an edge rusher. If you watch the Super Bowl, you get to see Tom Brady pretty much making their edge rush irrelevant because of the way that he can step up in the pocket and make it easy on his offensive tackles. Is where if a dominant three technique like an Aaron Donald attacking the offensive guard, pushing him into the backfield, into the quarterback's lap, it gives the quarterback nowhere to go, especially if he's a pocket quarterback like you see so much in the NFL. So I just think that if all things are equal and it's an edge rusher versus a dominant interior defensive lineman, I'm going to steer toward the dominant defensive lineman or interior defensive lineman if I believe he can create sacks, hits on the quarterback consistently, and impact plays in the backfield in the run game.
I think that's going to come up a lot this year, too, because early read that I'm getting is you've got Key from LSU, who's, I think by most accounts, a dominant pass rush prospect. But then you have some really, really interesting interior defensive line prospects coming up the pike, too. The kid from Clemson, Wilkins, is one that that jumps to mind right away. So he's a guy who's an athletic freak at well over 300 pounds. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. That was the idea behind why people had such a high grade on Jonathan Allen last year around this time. We said he wasn't going to be that type of athlete. That turned out to be the case. He ends up going 17th overall. So we'll see how those things play out. But over the last couple of years, just we know Sheldon Rankins went highly because of that same idea. And
Solomon Thomas. You know,
Solomon Thomas. Some people thought he would be an interior guy. I think I don't know. Have you heard anything out of San Francisco, how they plan on using him?
I thought that I heard that they were going to use him as a defensive tackle, but I'm not 100% sure, honestly. I thought they were going to move Armstead out to defensive end and play Thomas at three technique. I know a lot of people that know defensive line better than me on Twitter hate that idea, but that was I thought I read that. I might be wrong, though.
Didn't they say they were moving Armstead to linebacker or something crazy like that?
I think it might have been like a Sam, like a Leo, like on the line standing up or something.
Yeah, that's the writing's on the wall for that pick.
One hot take before we get out of here, buddy, Justice Mosqueda of Setting the Edge. You can follow them on the Twitter at Setting Edge. There's a 50% chance Justice will be on their podcast every week. Charles McDonald will be on the podcast every week hosting, so just follow along. But Justice dropped this gem on the timeline during the week. Why don't you like D. Arnold? Talking about Sam D. Arnold. And Justice responds, he reminds me a lot of Bortles. That's the one and only Blake Bortles. I think he's a day two guy, so I don't not like him. I just don't see the next luck, like some say they do. So so at JUMOSQ, you can get your takes off to Justice on why Day Arnold is not Blake Bortles. If that is the case, though, I can see the Cardinals moving heaven and earth because they love Bortles. So who knows what they'll do with Day Arnold if that's the case. Brendan, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it. Continued luck and good fortune on your journey to wherever you want to get to in terms of, you know, coaching and being a part of football, and we look forward to continuing to have you on as you move up the ladder. Hopefully we'll be able to hang out and keep this relationship going even when you make it in the big time.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Had a good time.
Justin, Brendan, thanks, man. It's been great to talk to you again. Long time no talk to you. Hopefully not as long next time. Hopefully you guys have a good year. Hiram, it's university, right?
Hiram University? College.
Hiram College, yeah. Division III. So for the nitty-gritty, down-in-the-dirt draft scouts that like to get into the small school ranks, Brendan's coaching at Hiram College, Division III school, and well, it's going to be a pretty wide open offense from what we hear, right?
Yeah, that's right. A lot of RPOs, air raid, broke a lot of records last year, actually, on the offensive side of the ball. So hopefully we can do some good things this year.
Well, we'll look forward to having you on after the season when you're not crazy busy, and then we can talk a little bit about what happened this season and if you're going to be watching any of these 2018 draft prospects. But thanks as always. Thanks for listening, everybody. Check us out on SoundCloud. Check us out on iTunes. We'll be back next week. I think we have another guest lined up for Why Your Scouting Sucks. So it's, you know what, people are stepping up to the plate, and we're going to continue to have fun with it. So thanks as always, and have a good night, everybody.